You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. What would you reward a person who risked his job, family, future, and life to expose a multi-billion dollar price-fixing scheme orchestrated by one of the most politically connected corporations in the United States and the world, agree to the role of FBI informant for over 3 years, wires and all, hand the United States Department of Justice its largest, at the time, antitrust victory, including $100 million in criminal fines, and place antitrust crimes on world governments' radar screens? If you or I can make this choice, we would probably turn this whistleblower into a national hero or international hero. If the U.S. government had this choice, which they did, they'd sentence this person to over 10 years in federal prison. My guest today is Dr. Mark Whitaker, played by the actor Matt Damon in the recently released motion picture film, The Informant. Dr. Whitaker, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be on the program, Dave. Appreciate the opportunity.
It's an incredible story, Mark. I read the entire book, The Informant, by Kurt Eichenwald, which, of course, I highly recommend. I know that this began when you were in your early 30s. Isn't that true?
That's correct. I joined ADM in 1989. I was, it would have been 21 years ago, and I was 32 years old when I joined them, and I was 35 when I started working undercover for the FBI.
Okay. And just so our listeners know, ADM is Archer Daniels Midland, and they were they probably still are stationed in Decatur, Illinois. Is that right?
That's correct. Okay.
And just tell our listeners exactly what ADM does for them, for the marketplace.
Okay. Well, ADM's one of the largest companies in the world. Even during that time, they were number 56 on the Fortune 500, and they're even larger than that today. They generate over $70 billion. That's 70 billion, not million, but $70 billion a year in annual revenues. And one of the largest companies in the world, with over 30,000 employees. And the best way to explain what they produce is when you go to the grocery store and you go and you walk down those aisles and you look to your left and your right and you pull any food or beverage off that shelf nine times, and you read that ingredient label on the side of that package of that food or beverage, nine times out of 10, at least one of those ingredients was produced by ADM in that food. And nine times out of 10, what your listeners had for breakfast this morning, some ingredient was from ADM in their breakfast.
Okay, so I guess that's why their tagline in their advertisements at one point was supermarket to the world.
That's correct. They are really one of the the largest food ingredient company in the world.
So you joined ADM when you were 32, and you were a doctor at that time, PhD?
Yeah, I was PhD about 7 years. I went right from high school to my bachelor's and master's at Ohio State, and then Cornell University in New York, where I got my PhD in nutritional biochemistry. So I was age 25 when I got my PhD.
Wow. You grew up in Ohio then?
That's correct.
Okay. And one of the products that ADM had dealt in, I imagine they still deal in, is something called lysine, L-Y-S-I-N-E. Can you explain to our listeners what lysine is?
Well, the best way to explain what lysine is, if you go to like a human health food store like GNC or Walgreens or CVS, right, you'll see lysine a lot of times there on the shelf, and a lot of times used for cold sores. And so it's very common in the human market, but the bigger market is really in the animal market, in the animal feeds, and used in poultry feed and swine feed as an amino acid to make basically livestock grow more quickly and more efficiently, because it helps protein synthesis happen a lot quicker. So I don't think you could find a pound of livestock feed out there worldwide that doesn't have lysine in it.
Right. Okay. So ADM was a big producer of lysine. And lysine was, I guess, at the center of this price-fixing scheme. Is that right?
Well, it was the initial product because it was a product that was involved in my division, which was known as the Bioproducts Division, which was really the Biotech Division, but it was named the Bioproducts Division. And that was the first product when I informed the FBI about the price fixing. It was a little easier because that was in my division. But it did spread, the case did spread to other products as time went on, into citric acid and high fructose corn syrup and so on.
So it started in lysine. It ended up that the information that you were handing over to the FBI exposed that prices were being fixed in other arenas. And of course, the undercover operation you really spearheaded, Mark, because even though you didn't instigate the operation, I think I'm safe to use the word spearhead. What do you think?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, and what was that called? That operation?
Harvest King.
Harvest King. Okay, and that of course was a price fixing criminal investigation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, now for our listeners, could you explain who was fixing the prices and how were they fixing the prices and in what surroundings were they doing this?
Well, we were fixing the prices with our competitors. For lysine, for example, there were five producers, and Archer Daniels Midland, or ADM, only being one of those five producers of that product. And antitrust laws strongly dictate that people go to prison for this, and they actually, ADM executives did go to prison for this, that you're not allowed to communicate with your competitors in order to fix the prices, because that's forming an international cartel, which is against the law. And that's exactly what we did do at ADM when we price fixed. We got together with our competitors, we split up the market and decided who would get Tyson, who would get Purdue Farms, and we split that market like a pie, so to speak. And decided who would get what customers, and also what volumes in each region. And by doing that, we were able to double the prices from about 60 cents a pound on lysine, which they were before price fixing, to about $1.20 a pound.
So you doubled the price, and of course that's felt right in the consumer's pocketbook. Is that right, or directly?
Exactly. It does. What happens is when prices are fixed on foods, in other words, if the lysine's fixed for someone like a Tyson Foods, when a consumer goes to the store and buys their chicken breast, for example, or their sodas from Coca-Cola or Pepsi, which was a high fructose corn syrup and citric acid and so on, when they go to the store, the people who produce those foods, the food manufacturers, are going to pass that to the consumer. So basically, every consumer that goes to the grocery lines are then paying a higher price. They pay for that. 50 cents more for a particular product, and it may only add up to 50 cents to a dollar on the actual grocery bill. But when you multiply that by billions of people around the world,
right,
that we were selling food ingredients to, that added up to over $1 billion a year. We were stealing over about $1 billion a year if you look at the multiple products,
right,
that we were fixing the prices on.
So $1 billion a year really gains that they shouldn't have had. They were doing it illegally. They were fixing prices with their competitors. How long were they doing this?
So we were doing it the entire 3 years I was undercover, but it was also proven in court that it was being done years before I even joined the company.
Right.
I joined in 1989, and lysine was new, so the price fixing and lysine was new after I joined, because that didn't start until 1992. But it was proven in court that for other products, price fixing was going on for years before I even joined the company.
Okay, so it could have been going on maybe for 10, 20 years, or maybe even longer.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know the exact time, but I know it was for years. And, you know, $1 billion extra a year for Archer Daniels Midland, just think the other producers are gaining that also. So, I mean, every producer of a product is earning hundreds of millions and up to $1 billion extra per year.
Right.
So then it becomes billions per year if you look at the multiple producers of those products.
Right. And so these other competitors, these weren't just domestic competitors. They were national competitors. They were international competitors, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We were fixing the prices with European and Asian producers of those products. So it was an international cartel. And these meetings took place in Zurich, Switzerland, and Paris, France, and Mexico City, and Vancouver. And I mean, they were all around the world. Even though ADM's a Decatur, Illinois company, these price fixing meetings were happening all around the world.
Wow. And these are lush locales, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I can remember taping those meetings. And I can remember lots of times the FBI gave me a recorder with a 45-minute cassette, and a price fixing meeting in Tokyo, for example, would last 3 hours. I would have to constantly look at my watch, and every 45 minutes take a restroom break, like clockwork, where I could run to the restroom, get into a stall, and flip that tape over where the 45 minutes ran out to the new side.
Right.
new side of that micro cassette, and go back in there, tape for another 45 minutes, and do the same thing all over again. And you had the video feed with a lamp. They had this green lamp.
Right.
And it looked like it was from a yard sale. And if there was a woman, good thing the 11 co-conspirators were all men, because if there was a woman among us, she would immediately notice that lamp that
was
looked like it came from a yard sale, didn't match the 5-star decor. And a woman would also notice that green lamp was following us around the world.
Right.
But that's where the video feed, I did the audio feed on, you know, the recorder in my jacket, the one in my notebook, and the one in my briefcase. But the video feed came from that green lamp.
And, of course, the FBI agents were in a nearby room where they were picking up all this information. Is that correct?
Yeah, they'd be in the next room, next door, watching it. As it's being taped, they'd be watching it on a screen, watching the video feed coming from that green lamp. Because someone sit in front of that green lamp in Hawaii during one of the meetings, and his back completely blocked the FBI's view. And I immediately went up to that person and said, look, the hotel's going to be bringing drinks to us in a minute, and we're going to need that table behind where he was sitting to put the drinks at. And I moved him about 2 feet aside, and that was where the FBI could get a wide view, because they were getting a completely blocked view because of that person's back blocking that video feed.
Mark, that was quick thinking.
Yeah, when you work undercover as a cooperating witness like that for the FBI, you really do have to think quick on your feet. I can remember another incident where a prosecutor, in the same meeting where someone blocked the lamp in Hawaii, they wanted the two words, "we agree," to come from the co-conspirators and not from me.
Right.
And I had to go through about 10 or 15 minutes of charades until one of the co-conspirators would say, "We agree to price fixing," to get those two words that they could show to a jury, both on video and audio.
Right.
And I had to go through all kinds of charades until someone would actually say those two words, "We agree."
Wow. And you did this for 3 years, or in excess
of
3 years?
I did, every day for 3 years. Yes. I took it very serious, even though I made horrific mistakes in taking $9.5 million the same time that I worked for the FBI. I did take their work very, very serious, and I tell you, they were proud. They were proud of what we accomplished and the amount of tapes that I got and the quality of tapes that I received for them. And I really did take that job as a serious job, and I tried to give them as good as quality as I could give them. When they asked for things like turn the tape over every 5 minutes, or when they asked when those tapes, for example, when someone blocked the lamp, and if someone was using one of these white paper easels, I would make sure that I tore off the paper, put that in my briefcase. That way they would actually have fingerprints and actually people's handwriting.
Right.
Things of that sort. And those are the things that I did. And most of the time, those are things that I did on my own, even without them even mentioning, just by thinking on my feet, thinking what they would need.
Exactly, because who knows if they would have thought of the same thing that you thought of. There's no way to tell.
Yeah, because a lot of times you don't know until it's actually happening.
Exactly.
Like someone blocking the lamp, so they couldn't have prepared that. They
That's
could
right.
not have prepared me that ahead of time. I just had to look, see what was happening around me, my surroundings, and make sure that they got the best quality they could get. So I did make some horrific mistakes. There's no doubt about it. I deserved a lot of the punishment that I received. But I did do the work that they asked me to do very seriously, and I gave them the best quality I could.
And all for nothing. I mean, you weren't getting paid. Of course, there were other factors in play, but you were not getting compensated from...
No, this was a completely voluntary job, something that my wife wife initiated. I would say I was the charcoal in the grill, but she's the one that lit the fire.
Right, exactly. That's right. Now, you contacting the FBI, really, that was precipitated in a great part by your wife, Ginger. Is that right?
That is correct. This case for sure would have never happened if it wasn't for my wife, Ginger. It's amazing. It took a stay-at-home mom raising three young kids that hadn't worked for almost 15 years in the workforce. I shouldn't say that wouldn't work. Raising kids is a lot of work.
But absolutely.
In terms of in the workforce, she was not working. And when I told her the very day why, about the FBI and how they were talking to us, and they were actually talking to us to help us. The company was going to close down one of the plants, actually the lysine plant, which was about a $300 million plant. And I told our chairman, and he said, instead of closing it down, because it was losing about $7 million a month, we were having some production problems. I said, I think, sabotage is going on, and I think if you give me time, I can correct this. I was really trying to buy time.
Right.
So they contacted the FBI in to come and help us, help ADM, not to investigate us. But I was coached what to say and what not to say by my management because of the other illegal activities going on. So they didn't want the FBI to catch wind of the price fixing and some of the other things we were doing.
Right.
So when I told my wife that very day about why I was nervous about talking with the FBI and why I was coached, that's when she put her foot down. She said, Mark, if you don't tell the FBI, I'm going to.
Right. It was the right thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. She was looking at it from the morally, do the right thing morally and ethically, and I was looking at it more from to continue to protect my job, to rise up the corporate ladder. Besides being divisional president of the biotech division, I was promoted to corporate vice president of the whole company 1 week before I met the FBI. So I did have quite a corporate opportunity ahead of me, a career ladder, and I just wasn't willing to give that up. Greed got in the way and ego got in the way, and it did not get in my wife.
You really went through hell. It was just hell. Your life had turned into an upside-down hell, hadn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the day after I told the FBI, which was November 5th, 1992, the following day, I was wearing three different tape recorders, one in my briefcase, one in a notebook, and one actually in my jacket. So I had three different tape recorders running every day for almost 3 years.
Wow. And these FBI field agents, these fellas who are talked about in the book, the story is just fascinating. How our own government, our own offices of the FBI, of the Department of Justice, are all fighting against each other for political purposes to get ahead. Did that surprise you when you saw that unfolding?
Yeah, I did. It really did, because actually the FBI agents, and there were four different ones that I actually worked with over those three-year period. Two of them were more supervisors, and two of them were the field agents that I worked with on a day-to-day basis.
Shepard and Herndon?
Right. Ryan Shepard and Robert Herndon. I would meet with them till midnight, 6 p.m. to midnight, a couple nights a week, going through all the tapes and debriefings and so on, a couple nights a week till midnight for almost 3 years. It was like having two jobs. During the day I was building the company, and during the night I was tearing it down,
right,
the very same company. So it was like two different lives, not just two different jobs.
Sure.
And they were opposing each other, one building and one tearing down. But those agents, those four agents, really supported me tremendously. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing how the political powers, it really affected that they even lost control of the case at some point.
Right. It almost was lost, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. And a lot of that my own fault, too. I did not make the case easier. I didn't make my family's life easier. And there's no doubt about it. I became I guess there's no better way to say it than a basket case. And I really became my own worst enemy.
Probably, Mark, most people would experience what you did. You were under an incredible amount of pressure. And you even had thoughts of ending your life, didn't you?
Well, I had two suicide attempts. It wasn't just thoughts. I mean, one of them, I was told it was 20 minutes from actually, based on carbon monoxide levels and so on, I was 20 minutes from actually being effective.
You went to the garage in your home.
Yes, that's correct. So they were two suicide attempts. It wasn't just
thinking about it.
No, I really dealt with some very serious mental illness issues. And I think, after I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder with that suicide attempt, but that diagnosis did not come until after the 3 years of working undercover for the FBI. But I think there was some underlying I think that the stress of working with the FBI made that worse, you know, untreated, undiagnosed bipolar disorder.
Right.
But we, when my wife and I look back, we could see certain signs but that I really did have it, but it just got a lot worse with the stress of wearing that wire every day.
I personally couldn't do it. I don't know how you did it. It really was a Herculean effort to do this, and for nothing really, just to help the government to do what was right. And your reward, as I said in the introduction, was prison. Now, of course, the reason for that were a couple of factors. You were accused of embezzling money from the company. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Not just accused. I actually did.
Did
embezzle money from the company. Right. During the time that I worked for the FBI, I did. Basically, I was involved with a couple smaller frauds before I even met the FBI with three other executives at ADM, which also were convicted. One went to prison, and two of them were on probation, and the other individuals. But we were involved with a smaller fraud. And then as I was working with the FBI, in the last 6 months that I was working with them, mm-hmm. that's where the bulk and the most of the frauds happened. I knew at some point that, you know, the FBI was telling me they had almost enough evidence to take the case public and prosecute. So I knew it was coming to an end, and I knew my job would be, my position would have been terminated, you know, once they learned that I was the FBI mole or the whistleblower.
Right.
So I took matters in my own hands and basically just kind of calculated what my salary was for a few years with the stock options and the base salary.
Right.
And just basically took that money myself to protect my family, and it was definitely $9.5 million, and it was the biggest mistake I ever made in my life, and it gave me 8 years and 8 months in prison because of that mistake.
Right. But didn't they take into account the incredible amount of pressure that you were under when they
They definitely have now. I mean, it's amazing. All four of the agents and one of my prosecutors are trying to give me a full presidential pardon. And because they said their own agents don't go undercover longer than a year because they crack under pressure. Here
sure.
I was untrained and went for 3 years. And their own agents also get psychiatric, psychological assistance every quarter, every 3 months when they're under
right. And
zero.
Who was it that really came after you, guns blazing? Was it one particular individual? Or?
No, and I would say they really didn't come after me. I mean, it was really my own fault. It was more of the Washington, D.C., fraud division, the Illinois agents and stuff were really supporting me because that's who I did the 3 years, you know, as a cooperating witness for. So they were obviously a lot more supportive. It was the Washington, D.C. Fraud division that really came after me, but rightfully so. I took $9.5 million during the same time I worked for the FBI, and I will say I deserved what I got, to be honest with you. I was my own worst enemy, and I feel I deserved what I got. Now that I can look back at it 20 years ago more objectively than I could have during that time, I made a lot of mistakes.
Right. But you received, and if this is correct, a three-time longer sentence than conspirators. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. I did.
You think that was justified? You think that you deserved to serve?
Probably not. And that's why I think the agents, the four agents and one of my prosecutors are so supportive of a pardon. I know that doesn't give my time back because I already did the sentence. I got it out 3.5 years ago. I got out of prison in December 2006. So I think that's why they're so supportive because they see in part of their arguments in their pardon letters. And I even went to Washington, D.C., where the FBI agents presented to government lawyers here just last year pushing for the pardon.
Right.
And one of their arguments is that ADM was stealing $1 billion a year. Some of the other executives and got 3 years, and Mark got 9 years for a $9 million crime.
Right.
Where's the fairness in this? So that's part of their arguments, too, in terms of they really argue that my case was minuscule compared to the one that I assisted them on.
So why do you think they were so aggressive, considering everything that you did for them? That's what I'm having a tough time wrapping my mind around.
Well, I had a very good lawyer who's a judge now in Chicago. His name is James Epstein. He's a state judge.
Right.
In Illinois, out of Chicago, and prosecutors actually helped me find him as a lawyer. He flew to Washington, D.C., and made the same arguments that we're talking about now, how agents get psychological assistance. I received none, how they don't go longer than a year undercover, and I went 3 years and was untrained, how I solved $1 billion-a-year case. In turn, you know, my case was $9 million crime, and, you know, the same arguments we're talking about. And they agreed to a 3-year sentencing deal for me, a plea deal, and they also said they would agree with a sentencing hearing where the FBI agent could come and make those same arguments
right.
in front of a judge, and he felt like I could have got a lot lighter sentence even than 3 years. because the plea deal was 3 years, but then a sentencing hearing could have got it down some because of mitigating circumstances, because of the mental stability or the instability I had during the time and wearing the wire for 3 years and all that.
Right.
And I fired that lawyer the following day and really kind of started fighting against the Washington, D.C. government group. And so I would have had a deal less than the other individuals' sentences, but I threw that out the door myself. Again, I was my own worst enemy during that time.
Agents Shepard and Herndon, of course, they went through a tough time also, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They did. And I didn't make that any easier either, because when I started seeing that I was looking at 10 years in prison and stuff, I became even, I started even attacking them. And it was a big mistake because they were really my biggest supporter. But I just wasn't thinking clearly back then. I can remember my wife pulling me off a driveway during a rainstorm during 3 a.m. when I was blowing leaves off with a gas leaf blower.
I remember that. I remember that part in the book, yes.
3 a.m. and she pulled me off. She said, "Boy, you need to come back to God. You need to come back to the family." And this was before ADM knew I was the FBI mole. It was after about 2 years wearing the wire. So it showed that I was really cracking under pressure and I wasn't sleeping at all. And I definitely needed to see a psychiatrist or psychologist. There's no doubt about it. I definitely needed to at that point, but I did not get that assistance. And I made the comment to her, I said, "Gosh, I'm going to be the next president of ADM. Who needs God?" I mean, that's how far gone I really was.
Right, exactly. You were under, as I said before, an incredible amount of pressure. Now, you were in prison for, you said, 8 years and 8 months. Where was the prison?
Correct. Most of it was split about half. About half of it in Edgefield, South Carolina, and the other half in Pensacola, Florida, at a Navy base.
And you're down in, and you stayed in Florida, and down in Pensacola after you were
That's
released.
Correct. That's correct. Life. When I was released, my wife, was a teacher here for all those. She moved to each location. She moved to South Carolina when I was there, and she moved to Pensacola when I was there. She visited every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for 8.5 years. She never missed.
Wow, that's terrific.
Yeah.
How many kids? And you have three children, Mark?
Three children, yeah. And she brought them every weekend. And we had our 31st wedding anniversary. Was this next month? We do in June.
Yes.
We've been together since she was in the 7th grade and I was in the 8th grade. And,
wow.
And the divorce rate for people in prison over 5 years is 99%. So we beat all odds.
99%.
Yes, for people over 5 years in prison.
How old are your children now, Mark?
32. 31 and 24. We adopted the two older ones when they were 5 and 7. They were natural brother and sister. And then my wife was pregnant a month later. So in 1985, we went from 0 kids to 3 kids, all in 10 months.
Wow. And how are they doing?
Doing great.
Good.
They really are. Doing great. I was teacher of the year two years ago. And she was teacher of the year, my wife was, in Pensacola. And my daughter's also a teacher. And the other son's working on his master's degree. And the other son that just moved to Texas, where he's moved to Texas in business. Yeah, they really not just fine. They thrive. They really. We all got stronger.
That's terrific. How do they? Are they confronted at all? Do their friends know that you're the informant you're Matt Damon. You're the character from the movie.
A lot of them do, but at that age, it's a little different than the age. I'm 53. I just turned 53 here a few days ago. And at the age of my children, it's kind of a cool thing. Hey, that's cool. Your dad was the informant and all
right.
that stuff. So for children, their age, it's kind of more of a cool thing. But
right.
Wife and I, it's kind of something we definitely try to put behind us.
You mentioned the pardon before. Is there any place that our listeners could go to take a look at information on this pardon attempt? Any website?
There is a website I have with www.markwhitaker.com, and that's WHITACRE, like acre of land.
Right, and it's Mark with a K.
Right, Mark with a K, and then WHITACRE.com. And it's got a lot about the pardon in there and so on. Mm-hmm. I have over a couple hundred letters written, including 4 FBI agents, one of my prosecutors on the price-fixing case, and a retired judge, and several senators and congressmen. So there's tremendous, tremendous support. But it requires 5 years out of prison to actually be eligible. And I'm only 3.5 years out of prison. And that's kind of been the main obstacle. That plus presidents just don't do many pardons. Bush did not do many, and President Obama hasn't done any. So, pardons are not a high priority on presidents' list, which I understand. But one of the hurdles for me, even if they were doing something, would be that I don't really meet that 5-year minimum yet.
Right. Is it important to you to get a pardon?
It really isn't. It would have been important if I was in prison, but the FBI agents going out and doing as many interviews as they've done, and they've done a lot, including in CNN and Fortune magazine and, you know, even our local radio and TV and newspaper here in Pensacola. So they've done, and those interviews are on the MarkWhitaker.com website. Them really going out and supporting me and talking about the pardon probably had more value than the pardon itself, because now that I'm released from prison and I already have a good job, I'm really back in my field. I was promoted a year ago to COO and president of a biotechnology company, so I'm right back in my industry. My family stayed with me. A pardon really wouldn't do much for me now, to be honest, compared to what it would have done while I was in prison.
Now, the pardon is supported by some senators, congressmen, even Harmon Killebrew, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Harmon Killebrew has supported it. John Ashcroft, who is a former attorney general, supports it. Four of the FBI agents that are responsible for the case, one of my actual prosecutors that put me in prison, is supported and wrote on my and has written on my behalf. The supervisor of the entire FBI agent, who's now retired, supervisor of the entire case, he flew with me to Washington, D.C. last year and made a presentation to government lawyers in support of the pardon. So the support really is tremendous. It's just that presidents just don't do many pardons, if any at all.
Right.
Plus, I don't meet that five-year requirement. They're trying to get around that five-year requirement because they feel like there's extraordinary circumstances, mainly the fact that I did not receive any psychological or psychiatric assistance during those 3 years. So they feel like it is an extraordinary circumstance, so they're trying to get around that five-year minimum.
Right.
And then Kilbrew, you know, is a baseball Hall of Famer.
Sure, I used to have his baseball card when I was growing up. Haven't seen that name in a long time.
Yeah, he does some endorsements for our company and stuff. So I got to know him quite well over the last several years, and he's been also a strong supporter of the pardon.
Wow. Now, that was September of last year, the movie The Informant, and of course, it's based, I don't know, it's probably based loosely on the Eichenwald book, The Informant, because it's considered, I guess, a dark comedy, Informant. And they put an exclamation mark after Informant, which, of course, isn't on the book, came out. And prior to that, I guess a month before that, in August of 2009, Discovery Channel aired a documentary called Undercover, Operation Harvest King. Of course, that was the FBI's name for this case against ADM. Now, tell me a little bit about that Discovery Channel documentary. Are they still airing that? Do they air it occasionally? Or
I do think they plan on, they've aired it 8 or 9 times already, and I do think they plan on airing it some more. And once they do stop airing it, they make it available on DVD. We do have the trailer of it. I think it's a 3 or 4 minute trailer on the MarkWhitaker.com website, which is kind of the conclusions of the three FBI agents, because three of the four agents were interviewed for that show, and my wife and I also on that Discovery Channel documentary. So it was very accurate and really kind of went through from start to finish the entire case.
Okay, and so folks can go to DiscoveryChannel.com and see when they might be airing that program in their local market. And the movie. Tell me about the movie. You saw it, of course. Did you go to the premiere? Yes, we did.
We went to Warner Brothers, flew us out to show us the movie privately in June. It didn't come out till September 15th, but they had a private showing for my wife and I in June of last year at the Warner Brothers headquarters in Burbank at their studios.
Okay.
And then we went to the premiere with Matt Damon and Scott Bakula and Steven Soderbergh, the director. And
right.
The movie, I think, was very entertaining. I think Matt Damon portrayed bipolar, untreated, undiagnosed bipolar very well, and I think that seemed to be the focus. The focus was probably more on untreated, undiagnosed bipolar disorder and all the mistakes and the crazy things I was doing.
Right.
Probably focused there more than it was even the case, because I think they felt the price fixing case itself wouldn't be as entertaining.
Sure, of course.
As that. So it was more of a dark comedy, and if you read the book by Kurt Eichenwald, The Informant, or saw the Discovery Channel, you can see it's far from a comedy. But they also, you know, that's why they call it based on a true story. They have to put the story in a format that people would be willing to go to the cinemas and watch. More entertaining.
Sure, absolutely. And did they have you as a consultant on the film at all? Or?
Well, I had the script for about a year ahead of time, and there were certain props like the ADM business card and things like that they would call every few weeks where they would need something or ask a certain question, you know, and we would send them stuff or answer their questions, things like that, but really not any kind of consulting or not.
How important was Ginger in this entire operation, Mark?
Well, I tell you, Ginger's importance is paramount, and was in the case paramount. I mean, first off, this case would have never happened without my wife, Ginger. And we've been together all our lives. Since she was in seventh grade and I was in eighth grade, we've been going together. And we've been married 31 years, and I wouldn't be alive today without her. And first, when we split into two parts, first about the case, she initiated the whole case. And when your value systems are clear, a person makes their decisions so easy. And obviously, my value systems were clouded, and that's why it was so tough for me to make the decision to do the right thing, because I was looking at my career, and I was looking to be the next president of ADM,
right.
Not just president of the division, but they told me I was a strong candidate to be the next president of the company. And I couldn't take my eye off that ball, so I was willing to rationalize and to do things that I shouldn't have been doing just because I really wanted to be the president of the 56th largest company on the Fortune 500. Versus Ginger looked to do the right thing morally and ethically, because her value system was so clear. She made that decision in 5 minutes and was willing to lose our home, our cars, which we did, and willing to lose everything. And I told her, I said, we could be homeless and I could go to jail. And she said she'd rather be homeless than having us steal it from every consumer around the world. And that's
wow.
Exactly what she told me when she made that decision. And an hour later, I was sitting 4 hours with the FBI telling them what was going on illegally at the company because of Ginger.
Wow.
And only because of her. And then not only did she start the case by doing the right thing morally and ethically, she stood by me for 9 years of prison and 3 years of undercover and moved to every prison I was at. And she was the super glue that held our family together. And we not only did we survive as a family, we thrived because of her. And she made a decision early on, and she told me my first 3 months of prison. She said, you know what? We're going to be a family that gets better with this, not bitter. And she said the only difference between those two words is the letter I, not the letters ADM or the letters FBI. Yeah, she showed that 3 months after I was in prison. I had 9 years yet to go. And we did. We did get better and not bitter. And my children, all three of them, got better and not bitter. And as a family, I tell you, we thrived because of my wife. She was the rock
wow.
of that whole case. And the aftermath and the collateral damage that happened afterwards. She was the rock that held everything together.
Where does her strength come from?
She's very faithful to God, and she has a lot of faith, and she strongly believes that to death do you part, that no matter what circumstances you're going through, you stick with your family and you never abandon your family. And boy, not only did she say it, she proved it.
Wow.
These are louder than words, because for people, 5 years in prison is over 5 years is 99%. Divorce rate, and we beat all odds because of her.
Wow. Was she portrayed in the movie, Mark?
Yeah, she was. She was portrayed very strongly. It was a small part. Melanie Lynskey did a great job portraying her, but it was kind of a small part. There's a lot more details about her actually in Kurt Eichenwald's book, The Informant, and a lot of details about her in the new book that Mark Whitaker sent to us that can be found on the www.markwhitaker.com site. Because it's really more focused on her about how she started the case and how she held everything together afterwards. So I would say the books have more about her than the movie, but the part that she was portrayed in the movie was very strong.
Right. You're a lucky man, Mark. You're a lucky man.
Yeah. Blessed to have her. I wouldn't be alive today without her.
Mark, it's an incredible story. Again, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out and for everything you've done, for the service you did for this country.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mark.